Hello, I'd just like to welcome everybody here tonight back to MHBN's webinars. Tonight the topic is working together, working better to support families dealing with parental mental illness. We have a very talented panel tonight. We've got John Clark, who's a consumer. We've got Dr. Kate Howell, who's a GP. We've got Dr. Nick Kowalenko, who's a psychiatrist. And we've got Professor Dorothy Scott, a social worker. I'm your facilitator, Michael Murray. I'm a GP from Townsville. And I'll first of all just briefly speak to our panel. John, you're from Tasmania?
That's correct.
What's the weather like down there?
It's cold and windy and rainy.
You poor fellow.
It's okay. We've got spring to look forward to.
Good. It must have taken you a lot of guts to write this, your presentation.
I'd been doing a little bit of stuff with COPME earlier and also doing some voluntary stuff with Beyond Blue. So I was more than happy for my story to be used tonight.
Thank you very much, and we're very grateful to you. Kate, how are things down in Adelaide?
Very good, thank you. Had a busy day.
Yep.
Looking forward to the discussion tonight.
Have you been consulting or teaching?
I've been consulting all day.
Okay, great. I've been one of your pupils in Townsville. I'm sure you remember when you gave that presentation on IBT, which we were very grateful for.
Yes, I have fond of Townsville. I'm very fond of because I spent a couple of years there.
I remember you saying that. Nick, how are things going in your end of the world in Sydney?
Things going very well in Sydney. It's been unusually warm. That's been really pleasant.
Good. May I just ask you, when you finished medical school and did your health jobs, what made you do psychiatry?
Look, I set out for general practice when I left medical school, and I became aware, you know, that I was seeing lots of people in whom I thought, you know, had psychosomatic problems or things like that, and I could identify them, but I had no idea what to do with them. That led me through my general practice training to start doing some work in psychiatry and community psychiatry, and that became my pathway in. I then forgot to leave it and go back to general practice.
Good. Thank you very much for sharing that with us. Dorothy, what's the weather like in your end of the world?
Well, it's cold and it's clear in Melbourne, and the screen has just gone blank, and a little thing said no signal. So I'm not sure if you can see me, but I can see no one.
We can see you perfectly. We can see you perfectly. So
Hopefully someone will come and rescue me, but I can
people,
hear you.
Our technical people will be onto that fairly quickly. May I just ask you something, Dorothy? How did you feel when you found out you were being presented with the OAM? That's the equivalent of becoming a dame or a...
Oh, no. It's much more modest than that. But what really touched me was that those who nominated me were the women I had worked with many years ago at the Queen Victoria Hospital, who'd been admitted to our psychiatric ward with their babies. We pioneered that back in the 1970s. And they told me they wrote letters from their heart to the Governor-General and nominated me. And I don't think perhaps... I don't think the Order of Australia is used to getting letters from the heart of women who had had such a serious transition into motherhood and were appreciative, probably for me bringing them together, which led to them having a support group which has lasted for 35 years. So I feel very honoured by the fact that they were consumers of mental health services.
That's a lovely story. Thank you very much for sharing it with us. I'll just go through the learning objectives tonight. At the end of the session, participants will be better equipped to recognise the key principles of intervention and the roles of different disciplines in assessing, treating, managing and supporting families dealing with parental mental illness. Also, to recognise the merits, challenges and opportunities in providing family-based collaborative care and support to enhance resilience in children dealing with parental mental illness. The format tonight will be the presentation by each of the panel for approximately 5 minutes each, and then we will go into a question and answer session where the panel will ask each other questions. And also where your questions as attendees, we have 250 attendees online at the moment. We had approximately 800 people trying to log on tonight. So we're very pleased to have all the attendees from all over Australia attending. We do realise that Kate has dropped out, and our technical people are chasing Kate up as we speak, but we can still hear Kate.
Okay.
So I'll just hand over to you, John, and you can start your presentation.
Yeah, sure. So just a couple of statements, I guess, from the consumer perspective, and you've got that slide in front of you. Just looking at the, I guess, the prevalence of children living with one or more parents with a mental illness, there's been some various studies. I read a fantastic paper by Nick Kowalenko and Associates, and they quoted a number of studies, anywhere between 14 and 28% were various studies of children living with a parent with a mental illness, so roughly about one in five. And the outcomes for those children were basically determined by a number of factors. So not just the parental mental illness, but also the other environmental factors around them, and then the risk factors related to the family, the social support, and the community. So to me what that's saying is that even though a child might be living with a parent with a mental illness, if they've got the right supports in place and they've got the right context in the environment, then a lot of those outcomes can be good ones. Just in terms of, looking at the consumer perspective and having the consumer as a participant in their own recovery and their own treatment, I just noted a few points there that listening to the consumers and including that consumer voice, it really puts the ball in the court for the consumer to kind of take ownership of their own recovery. And there's been a lot of talk about consumer-led recoveries, I suppose, and I suppose having a voice is the precursor to all that. Clinicians can tend to have an adverse effect of making consumers somewhat passive if they kind of take charge and dictate the terms of the treatment, I suppose. So sharing and decision-making gives consumers agency. It helps them become experts on themselves. I suppose everyone who's logged in tonight is an expert in their field, but nobody can become an expert on a consumer but them. And also, in a lot of treatment teams, the treatment seems to be quite fragmented, so consumers can tend to be going and seeing a GP or seeing a psychiatrist or psychologist, and they are the common thread between those treatment teams. So the more they understand, the more voice they have, they can carry those messages between those clinicians. And finally, there, consumers need to be heard because we need to be able to tell the forgotten ones. And so the forgotten with people expect much higher prevalence of medication use and mental illness or risk of mental illness among carers. And so they are consumers too, in effect. So I guess we're hitting on that tonight. So that's it from me, Michael.
Well, thank you very much, John. That was a really, really good presentation, very clear, very lucid, and very informative. Thank you very much. Kate, we'll just move on to you from your perspective as a GP.
No problems. I've just come back online. I know you can hear me, so Michael, you might like to move the slides for me.
No worries. I'll do that for you. You just tell me when you need them moved.
Okay. So first of all, I think most people would be aware that GPs are still often the first point of contact for individuals concerned about their mood or mental health or for their families or carers as well. And these days it's not unusual for a patient to come in and to say that they have looked at the Beyond Blue website and perhaps done a test, as John had done, and they've often got an inkling themselves that perhaps their mood is depressed or there's some other issue. But fundamental, really, at the outset is making that connection with the person, because it takes a lot of courage to actually come in and say, I'm struggling. And so, you know, John mentioned that sense of shame in his story a couple of times. So it's really important to put the person at ease and to really listen and pay attention in that first consultation and to build that therapeutic relationship. Can you move the slide? Thanks, Michael. So the assessment really begins from that first moment that we start interacting with John, and involves getting the story, gathering all the information, hearing the story. You do want to be mindful of doing a mental state examination during that consult and risk assessment, and to do an examination and to order any investigations that might be needed. Because sometimes physical problems, health problems, will present with anxiety or depression. Now, a lot of GP consults are 10 to 15 minutes, and so that's an awful lot to achieve in a short consult. So to properly assess John or another person presenting in a similar way, it will be necessary to, I guess, to target some of the key issues and to make that connection and to get them back as soon as possible for a longer consultation to complete the assessment. And so safety is one thing that somehow you have to weave in there and ensure that, that he is safe until the next consultation, or to put some safeguards in place. Could I have the next slide? Right from the start, we can begin with psychoeducation. And you know, I'm sure a lot of people have had that experience. When they see the doctor, they leave and they've forgotten quite a few things. So, you know, we just need to feed information gently and steadily. And I think right from the start we can convey a sense of, you know, first it did take courage to come in, and but also a sense of hope or reassurance. That's probably top of the list from a patient's perspective, that they want to know that things can improve. And as we go along, we, you know, we can feed information around other agencies or people to contact if there is a crisis, or other resources that might be useful. Thanks, Michael. Overall, when we hear the story, which may take a number of appointments, what we're trying to do is pull together some understanding of the broad contributors to the presentation. So what are the biopsychosocial spiritual factors that have been involved? And together with the patient, we can then try and identify, you know, what are the key issues that the person's struggling with, what do they want to work on, and prioritise them. You know, if their main issue is they've got exams in 6 weeks, that's going to be top of the list for them. Or if they've got a work project that has to be finished, that might be their main priority, rather than, you know, our concern about mood or alcohol or whatever it is. So together we have to identify some goals and a plan of action. Thanks, Michael. Often it's easier to start with the more behavioural aspects of treatment, so addressing lifestyle factors such as sleep, eating healthily, engaging in some exercise if possible, even if it's a 5-minute walk once a week to begin with, looking at stress management, and John certainly felt very stressed with work and a range of other factors. Other lifestyle factors that may be addressed along the way are things like work-life balance or any drug and alcohol issues. And prior to being a doctor, I was actually an occupational therapist, so hello to all the OTs out there. And I picked up in John's story that he really enjoyed fishing and motorbike riding. And so hearing that, we can encourage him to engage in those sorts of activities early on if possible, because they give him some pleasure and they mean something to him. Next slide, Michael. Management, potentially psychosocial approaches and or medication. And the GP may well be involved in prescribing and monitoring medication and may also refer to a psychiatrist for assistance in that. And they may well be involved in providing support and counselling depending on their experience. I noticed John was prescribed an SSRI by the GP. Some GPs have undertaken additional training, so they may have some competencies in the areas of problem solving, relaxation, CBT, etc. And then there's a, you know, another group of GPs who perhaps made mental health their main interest and done a range of postgraduate courses. Thanks, Michael. We may refer to a psychologist or another mental health professional for further assessment and psychological therapies. And it's important for GPs to have a good understanding of what everyone does and who they can refer to in the local area. With John's history of trauma and the suicidality issues, I'd be wanting the opinion of a consultant psychiatrist as well. And central to his recovery will be assisting him, you know, whoever's involved in his care, the managing the range of emotions he's experiencing and rebuilding his sense of self and his strength. Thanks, Michael. I'll speed up here because I'm aware of time. Certainly the GP may have met John before, may not have, may have met his family, and it's important to offer support and services to his partner and children, and I know we're going to be talking more about that afterwards, so I'll move on to the next slide. And follow-up, incredibly important. That didn't really happen to a great extent in this case, but you know, I'm mindful that with starting any medication in that initial phase, there can be an increased risk of suicidality. Often we have to adjust dosage, and also ongoing follow-up. You know, a lot of people will feel a bit better and decide to stop treatment, whether that's medication or seeing a psychologist, and we need to put in place a good relapse prevention plan as time goes on. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much, Kate. Nick, we'll just move on to your presentation now, thanks.
Okay, thank you. So just to put this in context, I've kind of taken John's story as he's written, and I'm presuming most of you have read it, as if that's what he'd walked into my office and told me. So I'm just probably taking a fairly clinical perspective and kind of sticking closely to John's actual account. And I'm just because I am a child analysis psychiatrist, Kate's talked about a consultant psychiatrist. That usually means a general psychiatrist, and that generally means a person who predominantly or exclusively sees adults. So I'm going to give you the perspective from each of these two. Well, one said speaking for my colleagues, general psychiatrists, and also the specific kind of view of a child and adolescent psychiatrist and how their principles of assessment management just might be slightly different, and a slightly different emphasis. So I'm just moving on to the next slide. Good. So the first thing is that really the GP, you know, from John's account, has clearly made a diagnosis and initiated a treatment that, at least in the way that John's presented it, has been reasonably effective over time. Although, as Kate said, there might be some issues about monitoring some of his risks. But the key issue, you know, with GP referral, because that's your gateway to access specialist service, is what's the specialist being asked to do? Is the client being referred to talk about management and advice and support for the GP, an opinion and advice only, or the notion being with a fairly quick hand back to GP care, or is it, for example, a phone call and advice only? And they're all obviously quite different. Some rural and remote GPs access psych support, which they access through their divisions of general practice, or I guess they might soon access them through Medicare locals, which is a way of getting feedback from consultant psychiatrists, usually by email within 24 hours of them submitting an email request and getting kind of broad outlines of a clinical situation. So that's a resource that's been very widely used in rural and remote settings particularly. And then, of course, there are some websites, and particularly for this area, there's a COPMI website, which addresses there, which has a pretty wide range of resources that are available, including professional training and other, and a whole lot of consumer-based resources that John's had a role in developing. And they're all kind of there, and they're a really handy resource for people in primary care to access. Kate's made a really clear point about the kind of risk issues, and she's also made a point that there might be risk to others, particularly in his family. he has made a bit of a point about fluoxetine, which has helped, but it's also had some side effects, so that has to get managed at some stage. He has raised concerns about the impact of his behaviour, really, over the last couple of years, particularly with respect to his relationship with his wife and also the impact on his kids. And he specifically identified his nine-year-old as expressing, you know, some kind of worrying thoughts, which he's pretty well aware of. And just like Kate, after the first session or two with him, with his consent, I'd want to give him a rationale about why I'd want to involve his wife and see her as part of an assessment kind of process. Then I just wanted to... Kate's made a good point about how important it is to establish, you know, a therapeutic alliance, a way of talking with John as a person. So my kind of impression of John, you know, I've called it his personhood, is that if I look very carefully at the script, the narrative, really, that he supplied of his experiences, he comes across to me, and this is my impression from that information, as an analytical and measured kind of bloke. He uses what I call denial. You know those stories about how he avoids things and stays away from his workmates and his family and all that stuff. I think he thinks of himself as a very self-reliant guy and someone who, certainly his narrative is very methodical and has a really authentic kind of voice because of the care with which he's obviously thought about some of these issues. Like Kate too, he's really got some very strong views about his manhood, the significance and importance of his work role. But he's got a significant pastoral role too, and so I'm kind of interested in how all these things come together and what they mean in terms of John's values about himself. He has developed what he's called this kind of space in his life called a third space now, because he seems to have had a home and work balance, and in management of depression talk, we can talk about this potential as being a space where he has, you know, pleasurable activities and he has a bit of time for himself to think about things and reflect, and things he likes to enjoy. I like his description about the glacial onset of his symptoms. It's a very common finding. It's kind of not like suddenly it happened, someone woke up one day and discovered they were depressed. He really gives a really nice account of recurrent crises. Every step along this way, it's like a steps kind of approach, is a crisis in his illness. There's a crisis of... coming apart in terms of his family. There's this crisis, there could be multiple crises in his workplace from the way he's describing his dysfunction at work. Wouldn't he be a great workmate? And there's kind of stories there about the crisis as he reaches the point where, yes, he thinks this might be a health problem. He delays. He thinks it could be depression, and he kind of delays accessing treatment because he's just going to soldier through on his own. And there's another point where he gets a script, but I don't think he feels it for ages. So each kind of step is in a kind of adjustment to try and work out what he's going to do next. And by and large, he avoids delays and, I think, denies a bit. He's the kind of guy who, my impression was, he might struggle. I don't know, this is kind of a guess. He's a guy who might struggle with accessing and sustaining a helping relationship. And I'd kind of point that out to him because of his emphasis on, you know, his notions of manhood and his sense of shame that Kate's talked about. I'd be really interested in how a bloke who has thoughts about hanging and imagines it and thinks about it and, you know, Googles it, I'd be asking about how he relates these kind of things and thoughts about that to his spirituality. From his account, he's very family-oriented. And he can do a thing that's unusual in that he can put himself in the shoes of others, like Nanny, and talk about kind of how Nanny would be looking at him. He's a bit guilty, I think. Well, it's not quite overt, but it's covert and there in his story. And as Kate talked about the importance of trying, he's also quite a resourceful guy. That's the other point I haven't made. He's quite a resourceful bloke about how he's slowly dealt with these glacial issues. And there are lots of reasons to engender hope, and I talk about that quite specifically with him. It's important to work towards a full recovery and what that means. The importance of getting yourself better. He's talked about a number of his relationship issues. There are some issues about, you know, his family of origin, where he talks about his mum being a victim of domestic violence, but he has no memory of it. I'm kind of interested in that. It's something I might come back to later after I've done a more sort of fulsome assessment. If I've got a referral from the GP and it's kind of opinion and management, I would talk with the GP, or I'd certainly write, And we would think about whether a social worker, for example, might be the right person to talk about his couple difficulties. And that's kind of a decision I'd work up conjointly with a general practitioner. We would think about whether a case conference or some sort of coordinating meeting is relevant, and that's where a kind of mental health professional network kind of function would be really important. Kate's made a point about relapse prevention. Okay, if I'm a child psychiatrist, I'm just, how am I going for time? Am I kind of 5 minutes up?
You're going fine, but maybe more prolix might
okay.
be better.
All right. So if, as a child psychiatrist, this nine-year-old kid, John, might have got referred to me from any one of these four sources, which you can see there. So a social worker, you know, might have started seeing the couple because of their couple difficulties and might have thought there was persistent marital conflict and wanted a child and adolescent mental health professional involved because of the impact on the kid. And these are the kind of other, you know, these are crises in terms of how he might present, for example. And then, you know, from a child psychiatrist perspective, the child is referred, a slightly different approach about ensuring that you meet with whole family if you can, some time with a couple alone, an interview with the child alone, and explain some of the issues about confidentiality with the child. One of the big differences, probably in child psychiatric practice, is to ensure that you get corroborative information, not only from parents, but with their consent, that you might talk to certainly the person that referred them, and usually you want their school as a minimum. And then spend a lot of time about feeding back your findings to the family, clarifying with the child alone what they're comfortable about sharing with their parents or other members of their family, and working out together with the family, probably the parents really, about having given an opinion about next steps for treatment and management. So if I had seen this nine-year-old, I would hope it would become apparent that dad's quite depressed and that's a really a crucial part of treatment. I don't know much about mum, and that's something I want to assess in terms of the family functioning. There are some things that might get fed back about the individual child, and I'd ensure that the kid participates in kind of giving an account, a formulation of how this has happened to this family now, the impact on the kid and feedback, and then work out the next steps together. So a number of you made a point about the importance of psychoeducation for the whole family and coordinating with others with their consent. It's important that this is done in a way that empowers parents. And there are usually a range of options regarding intervention, and they have to be prioritised with parents and with kids. And the aim of this is to really make sure that the couple become more confident about managing these difficulties with their own kids and become more competent. And that, I guess, you know, in some ways that's acting more like a coach. And family focus is a specific program that I'll probably talk about a bit more as we get more into this kind of panel discussion. Okay, so thank you.
Thank you very much, Nick. And now, Dorothy, we'll go to your presentation, and I will move the slides for you. You just cue me when you want them moved on. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, I want to start from the beginning and say, well, I'm not a clinician. A long time ago I was, and very privileged to be part of the early narrative in the evolution of a more family-sensitive way of working in the mental health field. But there are many people here with us this evening who are far more skilled than I in how on a day-to-day basis to put that into practice. And I'm particularly mindful we have Dr. Vicky Cowling, a psychologist and social worker with us this evening, who has really in the last two decades helped the whole field of mental health move to a much more child and family inclusive way of working. So many, many years ago, right back in the 1970s, let's start with an historical context. Some of us were working, myself included, to move from focusing on the mental state of the individual client to looking at the relationship. And this was particularly so with mother-infant relationships. And I've used there in the next slide, or perhaps it should have been with that slide, the logo of the Women's and Children's Hospital in Adelaide, because that captures so nicely how you can see mother and infant simultaneously. But we basically ignored fathers, and we basically ignored children other than infants. Whereas if we move to the next slide, to the policy advocacy of today, I've taken a quote out of a report that I was part of in a major inquiry into the Victorian system for protecting vulnerable children. And you can see there that what we've said to this state government, and similar things have been said to other state governments, that we really need for adult specialist services, that's mental health, alcohol and drug, problem gambling, family violence, it could go on and on, those services really need to look at themselves in terms of their family-sensitive practice and really how are the needs of sometimes very vulnerable children of the adult clients identified and responded to. So just to put that in the broader policy context, if we move to the next slide, please, I would say that the way a social worker would respond, and I'm very mindful that I'm not practicing on a day-to-day basis as a social worker, but more in the policy domain, would depend very much on the organisational context and how the situation in John's family had come to their notice. So the social worker could be a mental health social worker in private practice and be linked into working with local GPs. The social worker could be an adult mental health service or a child and adolescent mental health service and be part of a team. A social worker could be in a relationship counselling service dealing with marital conflict. A social worker could be in an employee assistance program in John's workplace, for example. Not necessarily in John's family situation, but often social workers would be in alcohol and other drug services, in family violence services, and in some situations with very hostile verbal conflict, then neighbours might have alerted police and the child protection services may have become involved, or a school counsellor may have become involved around a concern for a child. So I guess what I want to draw our attention to this evening is a whole range of organisations which potentially could become involved. And the next slide is the position that I would like to advocate, and it comes from the UK and their Social Exclusion Task Force under the former British government, but perhaps all organisations aiming to be family inclusive would need to be doing an audit on themselves. Are they always a no wrong door? That is, can they link up services, no matter who comes through their door, to the sort of service the family might need? How do they look at the whole family, seeing their adult clients as parents and thinking about the children? How do they build on strengths and how do they individually tailor their response to that family's needs? So that's the broader policy context that I want to push us along the path of. And, of course, that's not easy in organisations with certain performance indicators, with certain caseload pressures, with skill sets among staff that might not be able to rise to that occasion, and the culture of some organisations. I can see we're already on to my next slide, and that is that for me as a social worker, and this wouldn't be that different from some of my colleagues in other disciplines, depending on which setting I was in, I would be asking myself, who is quote-unquote the client, and what is my duty of care to particularly vulnerable family members of my client? So depending on where you sit in the service system, how do I hold in mind the needs and the risks that might be associated with other family members flowing from the needs of the primary client, which of course in some settings would be a child, in other settings may well be the parent with a mental health problem. I'd also want to be asking, hopefully regardless of which setting I was in, how are family relationships being affected by parental mental illness and vice versa, to get a sense of what is happening in this ecology of the family? And I'd want to be asking, what are the stressors, but also what are the strengths in this family and in its wider social environment? So that would include members of the extended family, neighbours, church and other social networks. What are the strengths and the resources on which we can draw as we move forward with the family? And last but not least, I'd be asking myself, how do I work with other service providers involved with this family? And that's going to become really tricky if we have different definitions of the client and we get caught in conflict where some are seeing the interests of some members of their family as their primary focus and other service providers are focused primarily on another family member. So in some situations, there's a real potential for tensions across professions and organisations in relation to one family. In the last slide, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because I know we want to move on, but I've just put a list there of the types of challenges we often have to overcome to work together in a family-centred way. There may well be inter-organisational dynamics of gatekeeping and poison ball, trying to push families onto another service. We may well have very narrowly focused services because of the funding models. We may have within our organisation at that inter-organisational level a culture which is not conducive to collaboration, which may even need another organisation to be the common enemy to hold us together in our own organisational teams. We may well have interprofessional rivalries and tensions and turf wars and hierarchies that get in the way of client-centred practice. There'll always be interpersonal issues, and so how do we make the wheels go round as we're communicating and working together? How are we mindful of the complex privacy issues in sharing information? And last but not least, the potential at an intra-psychic level for us to become caught in conflicts with one another where we are displacing hostility, where we're projecting a level of responsibility on others which is unrealistic, particularly in high anxiety situations where there's the risk of self-harm or there's the risk of violence in the family or harm to children. So I just want to take us to a broader level, I think, beyond perhaps John's specific situation to some of the common challenges. And that was my last slide. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dorothy. Well, we've come through the four presentations. We've come from John through the general practice point of view, onto the psychiatrist point of view, and then onto a much more systemic point of view from our social worker. We'll now move to the part of the webinar where the panel will ask each other questions, and attendees are also invited to posit questions in the text box, and I will try and field those through to the panel. Now, let's just move to this GP in this case. Nick, I believe you had a question that you wanted to ask Kate about best practice.
Hello, yes, thank you. I was just going to ask Kate, do you think John's GP provided best practice treatment and care, Kate?
My answer is no, and I think from what I said earlier, that you know potentially the GP can have a you know significant involvement and do you know a thorough assessment and be involved in the management at all stages and provide you know good follow-up, appropriate medication, be involved in, you know, referring to appropriate people, be involved in providing the psychological input as well. So I was very disappointed, as John probably was, to get a sense that he had one appointment, medication was prescribed initially at that appointment, and that there was very little else. There was that other phone call, but you know, I think what I outlined was more a best model of care rather than what was provided.
Thanks very much, Kate. John, did you have any comments on that?
I really appreciated what Kate actually put on her PowerPoint there, just how detailed GPs can be. I suppose she's got a special interest in mental health, and when I went to the clinic, I basically was pretty desperate. So I just said any doctor will do. Just you know, I need to see somebody. So I just got put through to anybody, irrespective of whether they had a special interest in mental health at all. So I suppose there's lots of room for improvement there.
And John, I also believe that you had a question for Dorothy as to how a social worker might have been able to assist your family. Could you expand on that, please?
Yeah, I really appreciated Dorothy's presentation as well. Just looking at it holistically, I think was fantastic because, I suppose I didn't rub shoulders with any social workers during my my recovery phase. But looking at what you do, I guess you tend to look at the whole family unit.
Yes, John, that's the training of social workers, but we are sometimes really constrained by our organisational settings, which push us to look at one family member or one aspect of one family member's problems. So I guess sometimes there's a tension between where our professional focus is and organisations re-socialising us into a narrower focus. So your question, I think, was how, when all hell was breaking loose for my family, what sort of things could you do to intervene and help manage the well-being of my wife and children? And I think that would very much depend on how the family situation had come to a social worker's awareness, whether that was through your wife seeking assistance from a relationship counselling service, whether it surfaced through a school counsellor in terms of concerns about children, or even perhaps through an employee assistance program. But I'd like to think that regardless of the organisational context, that what I would have done would have been to try to glean from whoever in the family was talking with me that there was a serious issue in relation to your mental health, and I would have tried to get you connected as quickly as possible with a responsive, good GP and or psychiatrist, because I hope I would have been able to read between the lines just how serious the situation was, and I would have seen that as requiring the intervention of a psychiatrist, and I would be wanting to get you to a psychiatrist as quickly as possible, perhaps through another family member. But in the recovery phase, I would hope that a social worker would work with all members of the family to try to help repair relationships which might have been hurt, and to try to draw on the skills and resources in the wider social network, and to perhaps draw on spirituality, as that may be a resource within your family, and perhaps to offer support groups where they may be useful, but for some people that's not what they're after, but to really keep you and your family in the very centre of all that we do.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Dorothy. I was particularly interested, Dorothy, in one question that you had formulated for Nick as a psychiatrist in relation to under what circumstances he might consider seeing the partner and children. Could you expand on that a little bit, please?
Yes, and I think Nick has taken us a bit into that in his presentation. It's obviously terribly delicate, and when you're dealing with a situation of acute risk, even raising the issue about the impact of a client's mental illness on their family members could intensify guilt. And so I was interested in how, Nick, you, as a psychiatrist, as an adult psychiatrist, say, would be explaining and seeking John's permission to reach out to his wife and possibly the children. How do you negotiate that with your patient?
Well, John's narrative is kind of pretty fulsome in the way he expresses his own awareness and concerns. That's that thing I was saying. He can put himself, you know, in Nanny's feet and in her shoes, as it were, sorry. And he can see, in a sense, he's describing himself as a bit of a monster. So I would ask him a bit more about that, in fact. I mean, because he's got a kind of, he's got an emerging insight about how difficult he is. I mean, his story about what he's like at work, etc. So I'd ask him to expand a bit more about what does he think he's like in his relationship? What does he think about the impact of his illness? In one sense, I guess I'd be being a bit merciless with him, because he certainly has a degree of guilt, but he also has a kind of core of authenticity about his story. And I've kind of got the sense he's a resourceful guy. I take your point there might be certain sensitivities, and they are things that would come over time. But what I would do very early on, and probably in my towards the end of my first assessment of him, is ask him about if it's okay if I meet with him and his partner together. Because I think he's clearly talked about the importance of his partner. He's talked a bit about how his illness has made him behave like a monster towards her. And he's talked about the kind of risk of them separating. There's a whole lot, and the sense of a real crisis in his relationship. I would talk to him frankly about him having an illness, about it being a serious illness, and people with serious illnesses, you know, need people close to them to help them out a lot. So there's kind of those kind of things that I would talk to him about. And it's important to know just what his thinking is about this, how far along the line he is along, you know, this kind of pathway of worrying about these things. And the long run is, it's critical to get someone who he confides in. And the impression, I'm going to ask him specifically, who in your life is your confidant? My hunch is he might say Nanny, he might not. And that's the person I first want to rope in to kind of join him in this journey, because it's also going to assist him deal with this stuff about avoidance and his problems about accessing care and staying in care. I want someone that he trusts to come along to start this ride off and to come along with him.
Thanks very much, Nick. Sharon Young, one of our attendees, has questioned, but we haven't really talked all that much about psychology tonight. Kate, would you like to just talk about some of the strategies that some of your psychological colleagues might be looking at?
Sorry, Michael, can you just repeat that question?
We haven't spoken much about psychology tonight.
Yes.
Would you be comfortable discussing how some of your psychological colleagues might approach this case?
Yes, for sure. And the reason I can, I guess, talk from that perspective is I have a multidisciplinary, I work in a multidisciplinary practice, so we have a team-based approach, and with several psychologists and half a dozen psychologists and a couple of mental health social workers and a mental health nurse and so on, and visiting psychiatrists. So I work with them every day. And, you know, often we'll work in collaboration, and often when I'm referring to one of the psychologists, I'm thinking, you know, does their expertise match what this person needs? You know, are they going to be able to relate well to the psychologist as well, personality-wise? And the psychologists are obviously trained in very well in understanding people's emotions and cognitions and so on, and they often work from a cognitive behavioural therapy model, which can be very helpful in managing issues like depression or anxiety. But a number of them are trained in other areas too, like acceptance commitment therapy or narrative therapy. And they have expertise, obviously, in communicating with the person, with assessing them. Often it's very helpful to have an additional assessment, and in ongoing management in helping that person work through their key psychological issues.
Thank you very much, Kate. Yeah. Nick, can I just ask you a question, and I'll also throw this open to the whole panel, and John, you are a very, very important part of our panel. Comment has been made in some of the postings about GPs being extremely possessive about patients and not wanting to refer them on. Would anybody like to comment on that? You've been a GP as well as a psychiatrist, Nick.
Yeah. Look, it's not my experience. I mean, there may well be some GPs like that, I suppose, because there's an incredible wide variety of GP practices. But I think with the you know, with the emergence of better access and access to allied professional services, and those things being fairly readily available, they're not everywhere, my sense is there's a really strong use, a really much stronger kind of use of the team from a general practice base. particularly in allied, you know, services across the range. And one of the things that the COTMI project has developed is a specific training program, you know, about keeping children and families in mind. But we also have just developed a 6 or 7 session, fairly structured program about meeting with parents and their kids to build kids' resilience predominantly, and as a kind of preventive intervention to ensure that families' competence and skills and confidence are boosted so that kids' coping is improved. And the international evidence on this suggests that up to about 40% of the more severe difficulties that might arise in children as a consequence of more persistent and sort of, you know, ongoing mental health problems in their parents can be prevented. So that's a program we're looking to launch either late this year or early next year, depending on how all the funding works. And our aim is to get that into primary care, and it would be delivered across those allied professionals, particularly targeting psychology, mental health practice nurses, but potentially the whole range of people in the primary health care system.
Thank you, Nick. Kate, you mentioned something in our discussions before we went online about hope and about, you know, what John found most helpful. Could you elaborate on that and discuss it with John for me, please?
Yeah. The reason I raise it is something that's come from my experience, and intuitively I know how important it is for my patients. I also worked with a GP some years ago in Townsville, and he went back to the UK and did psychiatry training. And for his project, his thesis, he looked at treatment of anxiety in the primary care setting. And those patients were able to access a range of therapies and services. And when they were asked to subjectively rate what they found most helpful, at the top of their list were really the supportive, simple reassurances that, you know, it's good that you've come and, you know, we will work on this and things will improve. And I don't know, John, if you want to comment on that, but I've always held on to that research finding as very important.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're experiencing depression, you've essentially lost all hope and your confidence is smashed, your self-esteem is smashed. And I think with the whoever's treating you, you tend to borrow hope from them. And I love the idea of borrowing hope, and I love the idea of lending hope to people as well. I noticed that in your presentation. I thought that was fantastic. The psychiatrist that treated me, she was very confident, and I really did borrow hope from her, I guess. I think the therapeutic relationship can't be underestimated, and just the ability to resonate with someone, and I found the psychiatrist hugely empathetic and non-judgmental, and I really felt like she got me. So I think that was a massive part of the effectiveness of her treatment.
Thanks very much, John. Dorothy, you had a question for Nick in relation to other family members being affected, apart from the, you know, what we refer to as the index client or the index patient. Could you expand on that a little bit?
I'm not sure if it's in addition to what I've already asked, but it would be when treating an adult with mental health problems likely to have a significant impact on other family members, to what extent and how much we explore this with the patient. And I guess I was particularly concerned about the very high level of intense hostility which John has described to us. And when that starts to become a situation where is the risk for violence and the witnessing of violence, and particularly with someone who's acutely unwell, I'm interested before, Nick, that you were adopting a fairly challenging and probing approach. You really could see John's strengths and capacity to cope with that. But if I were to say, let's imagine the situation did have elements of real risk to the safety of others, how do you manage that with someone who's acutely unwell?
Yeah, I guess that's what my kind of frame that is, that I've worked off John's narrative, and he's telling us in one sense he's 2 years down the track in his story. So it's a really different stage, you know, or phase of his recovery, I think. And in one sense, I think you're coming back to an earlier phase.
You know, that
initial presentation when the risk issues, you know, were probably at their height. Although that's something I would ask him about. Is this when things have been worse, or they were a couple of months ago, or, you know, those kind of questions sounds important to establish. John, interestingly enough, talks a lot about anger, frustration, irritation, you know, that sense of being about to explode. I would ask him about exploding. And when did he last explode? And he talks about the explosions between him and Nanny and the impact on the kids in the back of the car. I'd ask him a few questions. Have you lost it? What's it like? What do you do when you lose it? You know, I'd get to what I'd ask him. Have you hit the kids? You know, he talks about the, you know, demand. Have you hit them? You know, do you feel you lost control when you hit them? Has it happened with your wife? I'd go through the kind of, in the same way I'd craft a question about suicidal risks and ask him about, you know, he's had plans about, you know, the fantasizing about hanging. I'd have to ask him about it. He organized, he planned to do this. He got a rope, you know, he got rope in mind. He, you know, got stuff in his shed. I kind of have to go through the very clear stuff about clarifying his risk, not only to himself, but his risk to his kids and his wife. And he's 2 years down the track, he'd be telling me. At the acute phase, I have to be, as you've really pointed out, I'd still be asking him, but I'd really have to make a judgment about his responses. Because I'd have to judge if he's kind of protecting himself, doesn't want, he may not trust me yet. There's all those kind of issues. They're the kind of things I'd be concerned about. I guess it's another reason why I talked about a fairly, very early on, with a guy like him, probably after the first or second assessment, I'd be asking about seeing his wife, and that's some of the things I want to also talk about with her.
Could I just ask whether you'd be wanting to see his wife individually or see them conjointly?
Yeah, I would start off conjointly because I want John to be there and hear what's going on. And then I'd come up with a rationale about why I might want to see her alone. And then that kind of creates a different space.
Thank you.
We're just, unfortunately, running out of time a little bit. There is one question that was asked frequently, and that was, I'll address it to you, Kate. How would you as a GP manage the side effects of the medications that John was put on? Because this is happening every day in general practice. People, you know, young males are being started on medications and are having sexual side effects. How would you manage those?
John had the sexual side effects and also had a sense of emotional, not having the lows so much, but not having good, you know, some good feelings as well, a bit numb, a bit neutral. There were two sort of side effects. It's important to discuss potential side effects first of all, and I think with all patients, you need to talk about the potential effect on sexual function. And there are some antidepressants, if you're going to, you know, if you need to go down that path, you know, when there's severe depression, that are potential, that have less troublesome side effects in terms of sexual functioning. So sometimes, you know, choice of antidepressant, you know, you have to look at, you know, what you think potential problems might be and really cut them off at the pass and make an appropriate choice of drug. Information is important. And the other thing to be mindful of, and this is why follow-up is so important as well, is, you know, everyone's individual and how they respond to a medication will be quite individual. In the same way as everyone's depression and story is, you know, it's very different. And so sometimes we don't get the right medication first off. Sometimes we need to change medication. Sometimes we just need to work with the dosage. And so that side effect of mood being a bit sort of numb, you know, it might be relate to dose, or it might be that the medication isn't quite the right one. So sometimes we, you know, watch for a while, because medications take a while to fully take effect, and take a considered approach. And sometimes we seek opinion. I'm lucky having visiting psychiatrists that I can actually email them or catch them in the corridor and have a chat.
Thanks very much, Kate. Now, unfortunately, we're coming fairly close to the end of this webinar. I'm going to ask each member of the panel to spend 2 minutes just in summation, summing up their thoughts and also the thoughts of others they've heard tonight, and also the thoughts from our attendees that you've seen in the text box. Dorothy, may I ask you to begin, please?
Yes, I'm very excited that we're at this stage in the journey toward family-sensitive practice in the field of mental health. I would really like us to look at the way supervision, clinical supervision, is supporting mental health practitioners to work in this more holistic way and be mindful of a whole family's needs. I'd also, of course, wanting to take it up again at a higher level to ensure that our organisations and the way they're funded, the performance indicators, the policy framework in which many organisations are operating actually give a mandate and give resources for family-centred work. And I'm particularly mindful that in rural and remote communities, we don't have the resources available, such as the wonderful clinical context in which Kate works, and that many of our colleagues do not have a multidisciplinary team around them to support them. So I'm really thinking about the long way we've still got to go on this journey, but also how far we've come.
Thank you, Dorothy. That was a very, very good summation. Nick, may I ask you to sum up, please?
Yes, certainly. I think just the complexity, you know, of family-focused practice. Dorothy's made a point about the kind of overview and the kind of macro issues, but also just, you know, the family. There's people who could present, you know, the nine-year-old could present, there's John himself, obviously, and there's a kind of, I guess Dorothy made the point, you know, about the employee assistance program. There's 100 places John could present with his difficulties, and they all need to roughly head in the same direction, which is towards identifying his difficulties and then working out as part of his recovery how he's going to recover his relationships and those sorts of issues. Certainly family-oriented practice, you know, is a core of child and adolescent psychiatry specialist practice. And I'm really looking forward to kind of providing that some of that skill and knowledge and expertise and delivering it in the primary mental health care system as we move towards training. And we'll be offering some supervision of family-focused as it begins to be rolled out and disseminated really across the nation. So I think that's going to make it accessible to, you know, those 1 in 5 kids who live in families where their parents have a mental illness. And I'm really looking forward to that. And then there's the job about how specialist care can be more sensitive to develop a family orientation. And we've been looking at the COPME project, you know, issues like how do we make family-friendly inpatient settings, for example, so that kids can see their parents while they're inpatient, those sorts of issues. And then I think the kind of corollary of part of what Dorothy is saying is that Medicare locals need to make these aspects about family-sensitive aspects of care key priorities. And there's few developments in primary care and in specialist care that need to kind of be leveraged with Medicare locals, where as we develop more local control of health service delivery, consumers like John need to be there, you know, letting people know about the importance of this area.
Thanks very much, Nick. And Dorothy, and as a board member of my local Medicare local, I will be bringing that to the next board meeting. Thank you very much. But it's nice to hear that you guys at a higher level are working on it as well. Kate, could I ask you to sum up, please?
Well, I've found the discussion really interesting tonight, and I'm seeing a lot of messages thanking John, and I think that's really important. for sharing. And it certainly, your story has highlighted the need for, I do a lot of training with GPs and other health professionals. I'm just going to keep that message going out there that, the sort of coming in and having one appointment and then the person disappearing is just not appropriate. So that's one important message from tonight. And I think the other message that has come out is the sort of holistic approach, and whether that's holistic for John and different aspects of his well-being, but also for the family. And I think wherever we work, whether it is in general practice or an agency, we have to be very mindful of making sure that care is provided, whether it is through us or whether it's through making appropriate linkages for the partner, for the children, and so on, and being mindful of that. One of the exciting developments for rural and remote is the Medicare telehealth item numbers, and we have a branch, a very new branch, an hour and a half out of town down the coast, and we plan to be doing some telehealth assessment with psychiatrists in town. So that is another service that's available for rural areas if the GPs or other health professionals can link up with a psychiatrist in town. And I think COPME was mentioned, and certainly there's a lot of very useful information on that website, and that's somewhere that we can refer consumers, clients, families, and so on. So I think that's my summary.
Thank you, Kate. That was excellent, as usual. Thanks very much for your contribution. Now, John, you began all of this. We're back to you. We've had all sorts of revolutionary ideas in the text of consumer-led mental health services. Would you like to sum up?
I would have loved to have been able to respond to all the messages on the right-hand side there, but I'm a bloke, so I can only do one thing at once. I can either listen to you guys or be typing away. So I chose to listen, but just to reassure everyone that the second half of my case study is going to be up on the Mental Health Professional Network website, which talks about the treatment that I did receive and some of the outcomes of that. But just really wanted to thank everyone for their well wishes, I suppose. I really appreciate that. Some of the issues, I think, for me were around the whole masculinity thing. I guess I just did the typical bloke thing of just harden up and stick it out, work harder, just knuckle down and get over it. And I think these are some of the deep-rooted things that we need to talk about when treating blokes. And I understand tonight's webinar isn't about treating men, it's about multidisciplinary teams and family interventions. But just to sow some seeds, I think masculinity, our sense of masculinity or our narrative about our masculinity can be a real inhibitor to seeking help, getting help, understanding our emotions, understanding what's happening inside of us, being able to talk about it, having an emotional vocabulary, all of those things all conspired against me, I guess. Probably just to let you know why I do what I do at the moment is I'm really just passionate about guys not killing themselves and about guys getting help and not blowing up their families and blowing up their partners and spouses and children like I did. And the more I talk about it, I guess, the more the message gets out there, and hopefully it inspires guys to get help when they need it. I've been really encouraged just listening to all of the panel tonight. There was a comment on the right-hand side. I don't know who made it, but it said, everyone should talk to everyone. And that kind of encapsulates the whole idea of a multidisciplinary team, everyone talking to everyone. But I guess what we've talked about tonight is the best-case scenario, and it's just been fantastic to hear everyone's perspective from the psychiatrist/psychologist. Nick, you can have two hats, social worker, GP, and the consumer voice as well, and to put all of that together, wouldn't there be amazing outcomes in the field of mental health? So I've been really inspired tonight, What we've talked about tonight is the best case scenario, but I think everyone who's logged in and been part of the webinar can all take small steps towards creating this, I suppose, in their own backyard. So thanks.
Thank you very much, John. I could not have summed up any better than you have, really, and we're rapidly running out of time. I will not be facilitating for the next three months. I will be a poor pilgrim on the Camino for the next 2 or 3 months, so I'm heading off to Europe shortly. So, but I will be thinking about you all and about all the attendees and thinking about MHPN and the great work that it does for mental health throughout Australia. I feel very privileged to have been allowed to facilitate this session. Thank you very much, everybody, and good night.
Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Yeah.